Welcome to Cool Science Radio. I'm Scott Greenberg. Hey, quick question. When was the last time you checked your phone for directions or ordered something online and tracked the delivery in real time, or just assume your bank transaction went through without a hitch? All of that, and a whole lot more, you'd never suspect runs on GPS, not just navigation, everything. Today, my guest is Katherine Dunn, an investigative journalist and editor whose work has appeared in Fortune, The Wall Street Journal, and beyond. In her new book, Little Blue Dot, How GPS Shaped the Modern World, Dunn traces GPS from its Cold War origins all the way to the invisible infrastructure humming inside our phones, our farms, our banking networks, and our power grids. The book blends narrative history, journalism, science, and geopolitics. But underneath this thrilling story is a genuinely unsettling question. What happens when we become critically dependent on technology we have forgotten that's even there? Well, I'll tell you what, let's find out. Katherine Dunn, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much for having me, Scott.
Let's just start off with a very, very basic. What does GPS actually stand for?
It stands for the Global Positioning System. And it's funny, too, because now there are systems around the world that are quite similar, and you sometimes hear them collectively referred to as GNSS and Global Navigation Satellite Systems, I believe. It's a world of many, many acronyms, I have to be honest. It would be nice if they gave them snappier names. It would have helped my book a lot if I'd had a few catchy names in there, but it's mostly acronyms.
Well, then let's just stick with GPS for the sake of this.
Yeah.
So me, and I'm sure like maybe many people, think of GPS as just a little turn-by-turn navigation. Mm-hmm. What was the moment you actually realized this technology was much bigger and maybe a little more powerful than, just getting from point A to point B?
It actually took me a while to stop thinking of it as navigation only. But there was a moment when I realized, in terms of the daily navigation that we use it for, it's so much more than that. And I used to track oil flows. I used to work for a company that does that. And so I would look at all these tankers traveling the globe. And a lot of people are doing that at the moment because they're looking at the Strait of Hormuz, right? And they're seeing just how narrow it really is. And that was around the time I got interested in this idea that GPS was starting to behave in ways that were quite strange. It was starting to get sort of manipulated and weird things were happening. Boats were turning up places they couldn't go. They were disappearing from places they couldn't go. Of course, in reality, they weren't, but their GPS signals were acting very strangely. So that was the first moment I realized that, you know, the navigation wasn't really just for me and you, which seems obvious in retrospect, but it took another couple of years before I realized that one of the things about GPS that's so transformational, that's really very rarely appreciated kind of outside the industry, is that it's a tool for transferring time as well. And it's very weird to think about time this way, but it's sort of the synchronization that keeps the global economy on beat. And it took me a long time before I realized just how significant that actually was. I was pretty deep into my research when I started realizing the extent.
I think a lot of people don't realize that GPS actually started as a military tool. Can you maybe take us back to the Cold War origins and what problems were the Pentagon and space programs actually trying to solve at the time?
Yeah, so you can go back as far as World War II, obviously, I do. You come out of that period and you have all of these tools for blind bombing and precision bombing. It's a relative term compared to what we have now. But of course, you know, the British and the Germans and the Americans and the Japanese were all going back and forth trying to bomb more precisely, you know, trying to bomb a factory in Germany, for example. And then as you get into the Cold War, what they're really looking at is, you know, is missiles. And it's crazy if you think about it, to get say you want to hit Moscow, from Virginia, you not only need to know where Moscow is exactly, but you need to know where Virginia is exactly. And those were questions they didn't really have answers to in the way that we think of them now. They didn't have that precision of knowing exactly not only where they were going, but where they were starting. So these were the questions they started answering. There is a system that predates GPS, but it's sort of its direct predecessor called Transit. And the roots of this system were all about submarines, nuclear submarines in the Arctic in the far north. And they were really about that sort of nuclear arms proliferation battle between the US and the USSR. And that was where obviously conflict was expected to break out. And it was about tracking, yeah, again, not just where Moscow was, but where is the submarine that has the nuclear missiles? Where in the Arctic actually is it? So it was originally sorting that problem. And then you get into the Vietnam War and all of a sudden you've got high-speed jets and you're looking at not only knowing where a submarine is, which you can have in two dimensions. It, of course, it's underwater, but you're looking longitude, latitude. And now you want to know where that plane is in three dimensions in order to kind of effectively drop the bomb. So it really is a precision bombing tool at its heart.
And then how did we make the jump from a military application to this thing that exists in our everyday life now?
It takes place over the course of several decades. One thing that surprised me is given the fact that this is so clearly military, it's always been, they often call it dual use. So it's always been open to civilians from the very beginning. And that was because I think if you think about it, even transit, which was the predecessor system, it was open to civilians. Very, very, very well informed, very specialized civilians, to be clear. So it wasn't just somebody on the street. You had to know a lot about radio. You had to know a lot about time. You had to be able to build a receiver. But these systems were very expensive. So there was always a process of justifying what you could do with it and how it could be open to civilian life. So that process takes, of course, you know, over decades, right? It's they're launching the satellites. It's really expensive. It's very time consuming. The USSR is launching their own system. It was actually a lot of surveyors and academics that started to realize how useful this was for civilian life. And I think the Department of Defense really underestimated how transformational it would be for civilian life. And they actually fought it kind of for a long time. It was other departments of the U.S. government that had realized all kinds of things you could do with this, like putting ships in harbors and making them safer. And they started to sort of wrest this thing out into more public civilian life. And there was this real tension within the U.S. government over what was the ultimate purpose of this system. And there is a point when the civilian world sort of starts to overtake the military world. And probably that moment, it was in the 90s, and then into the early 2000s, the U.S. government sort of decided to take the brakes off. They had made the system a little bit less accurate than it actually was. It was basically too good. So they had put these artificial brakes on to kind of make it not quite as accurate. And then eventually they realized they couldn't really hold back this force. And that is the moment that we start to think about probably in our lives of we start to get it in cars, we start to get it in phones, we start to get it in, you know, everything basically. But yeah, it's a decades long process for this thing to sort of blast out into the real world or the civilian world the way we think of it now.
I guess we should probably start with one very basic question, Catherine. How does GPS actually work?
How does GPS work? I know it's a good question, and it's all about how deep you want to go. The best way to think of it, so there's a minimum 24 satellites around the globe at any one time. And what this means is that the receiver sitting next to you, so if you've got your phone next to you, the receiver is in sight of four satellites at any one time. And those four satellites, they're collectively solving. They're really solving, it's a math and physics question. They're solving for four things. So your longitude, your latitude, I'm in London right now. So we know I'm almost directly on top of Greenwich at this moment. So we know really where I am. I'm on the sixth floor, so my altitude. And then time, the correction of time. So it's putting your cheap little phone, your cheap little clock in your phone in coordination with the atomic clocks going around with the satellites. And we can go deeper into how that works, but that is the essential idea. It's these four things that it's solving for. And it's using radio waves from the satellites to do the basics of those calculations.
So, of course, we always think of GPS as turn right in 300 yards or whatever it may be, or in your case, meters, I think. But it's way beyond that. I mean, beyond navigation, GPS is embedded in things most people would never guess. For example, maybe banking or power grids. What's the most surprising place you found it in your research?
There was this period I went reading loads and loads of newspaper clips in the 90s. You found it was being adopted in really interesting ways by specialists. But one of the earliest things it was used for was earthquake monitoring. I think that's why the Japanese were really early adopters of GPS. And they started using it in cars and stuff. But it was used for earthquake monitoring because at a certain point, if you sort of augment and supplement the system, you know, you could pretty early on, you could get levels of accuracy that were down to the centimeter, the millimeter. So you're looking at the foundations of buildings. Have they moved? Have they shifted? Has, you know, this level of accuracy, I think, was really, really surprising. For me, I do think there was a moment later in the book, I go to Norway. I go to northern Norway, which people might know is an incredibly electrified society, even though they're a major oil exporter. And talk to people there who worked in the transport service. And if anybody's been to Norway, you will know that they have these absolutely spectacular highways through the fjords. They have to do a lot of safety monitoring here, but it's not just that. It's if you want to plug in your Tesla or whatever in Arctic Norway, where a lot of people own Teslas, the geolocation of, you know, where your car is, where the charger is, the geolocations underpinning the electrical grid that's underpinning the telecoms base stations, all of that has an element of GPS in location and in time. So that's when the Norwegians started to kind of realize, oh my God, this incredibly digital society we've built, it's you've got multiple points of risk where GPS is a sort of a critical factor in the information that's tying this whole system together. But yeah, you can go pretty deep. You'll find it's in almost everything at some level.
I was very intrigued that in your book, you also mentioned that our food supply depends on GPS. And I'm wondering, maybe can you spend a few minutes maybe unpacking that a little bit? How does the satellite network connect to what's actually on our plate?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think so much of the book could have been about that, and very little of it is. But once you see the pattern, you can understand the places that it's really significant. So farmers were really early adopters. And once they got down to that precision level, centimeters, millimeters, what you really had is you could, you know, your whole field when you're doing planting, John Deere tractors and all this kind of equipment, you could do this precision planting based on ultra, ultra, ultra accurate location. So that's one way. But then also, you know, if you think about food as a global logistics business, then you understand that this is going to be used at every step of the way because it's going to be used in aviation, it's used in shipping at every single stage. You know, somebody will be tracking when is that container getting there? Is the food still going to be fresh? It's going to be on trucks. It's going to be, you know, in cars. It's going to be coming from the field to the supermarket. So yeah, but that is really, and in John Deere and farmers were very early adopters as well of this technology. They realized how transformational it was before, you know, everyday, well, not saying farmers aren't everyday people, but you know, people who are just driving their cars and that kind of thing. Farmers were way ahead of that.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we are in conversation today with Catherine Dunn, whose new book, Little Blue Dot, How GPS Shaped the Modern World. She traces GPS from Cold War origins all the way to the invisible infrastructure humming inside our phones. In your book, you talk about how fragile this system actually is. And I guess maybe some of the biggest threats out there could be jamming or spoofing or even solar flares. What's keeping scientists up at night about how fragile this system really is?
Yeah, I think what they're concerned about now is actually starting to happen. So you had a case a couple of days ago, depending when people are listening to this, you could see it in the New York Times. It was pretty well covered, where a group of scientists, including a guy called Dr. Todd Humphreys, who is prominently featured in my book, said, we believe that a Russian satellite is likely raining interference down from space. The reason this is so worrying is because this interference, you know, the radio signal coming from these satellites, it's very, very weak, actually. And although you shouldn't do this, you can't do this, it's illegal, how the jamming is happening is it's just overpowering this weak signal. So somebody has a strong signal on top of a building or in their hand or whatever, and it's just knocking it out of the way, right? It's just like if I was talking and you started shouting over me, that's kind of all it is. Then there's more complicated stuff, which is spoofing, which is sort of the wolf in sheep's clothing kind of thing, where you're impersonating a signal. And then you can start to play with how we experience not just location, but time. So it gets pretty trippy. And this guy, Dr. Humphreys, you know, pretty early on around 2012, he started doing these crazy experiments, these crazy public experiments to warn other people and also the US government. I suspect he also found it pretty fun, to be fair, to show people like what could go wrong. And one of the things they do is they sort of hack a drone to show that they can make a drone go in the wrong direction by fiddling with its GPS signal. And then they get on a super yacht and they show that they can manipulate the path of this super yacht just by fiddling with the GPS signals. He really started warning, and other people who were kind of in this field started really warning, that you could cause a lot of problems when you look at what's going on now in the Middle East. You know, if you send a plane careening into the wrong airspace, if you send a drone in the wrong direction, the potential for chaos is quite big. And we are starting to see this stuff happen in real time. Here in Europe, we're starting to see, loads and loads of planes have had their GPS locations, maybe not intentionally meddled with, but they're going through areas of interference, you know, and it'll be the transport minister for the UK or something going through the Baltic and their plane's GPS receivers will start experiencing manipulation. So yeah, what they were worried about is starting to happen, not at scale in the United States at the moment, but this fear of the interference coming from a satellite above definitely opens up where this could happen. Up until now, it's mostly been limited to places where a conflict is happening. It's a spillover from conflict. So the Middle East, East Med, you know, the front lines in Ukraine, all these places. It just opens up where this kind of interference is going to be happening. And if you remember that this was a military tool or is fundamentally a military tool, then it makes a lot of sense, right? And if you think about how conflict is happening now, how pervasive drones are, or, you know, missiles that are dependent on position and navigation or autonomous to some degree, you kind of realize what a big risk this is. And that's just in the military realm. And then you take all of the civil infrastructure that has the stuff baked into it and is not relying on the you know, encrypted military signals, and is not even controlled by the US government, is controlled by other governments. So yeah, I hate to give people one more thing to worry about, but it is interesting if you're into technology and you're into sort of stories about, we should think about where this technology ends up. And it's a beautiful, elegant, and amazing system. I would never say that it's not, but a lot of the vulnerabilities that people were warning about kind of, you know, 15 years ago are really starting to come true now.
I hate to go down that rabbit hole, but we have become so dependent on this system. What would you think would happen if the GPS system went dark tomorrow? Mm. I mean, and let's just say just for a day, just 24 hours.
Yeah.
What would that look like?
So one of the things you'd be finding out in real time is how good the backup systems are for all this infrastructure. A lot of it does have backup systems, but it's going to be a matter of how much those companies or those departments, if it's government, spent on those backup systems. And the big thing is the clocks. The big thing is the timing backup, because this GPS time, it keeps things totally like boo, 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 you know, in sync, right? And once you're not relying on that level of synchronization, it's did they pay for ground clocks? How much backup time do they have? One of the things that's so kind of scary about this is that, you know, a lot of people who work in this field have told me, we don't actually know. We don't know how long it would take for the digital systems to unstitch themselves. And actually, that's kind of the best case scenario, because In this worst case scenario world, because if the system just goes out, the backup systems at least know to kind of come into play, right? But if somebody, a nation state typically, interferes and feeds in false information into these systems, it's exactly like a computer virus in a lot of ways. Then the system can become unstitched in ways that you don't know if, is that mobile base station, is the national grid going to detect that all of a sudden there's a weird time in the system and they're not all matching up, you know, as electricity goes or as digital signals go, it starts to become kind of frazzled. So we don't know. There have been a few cases where this kind of thing has happened. So I think it was in San Diego. It was a ship, a U.S. Navy ship, they accidentally left a jammer on. And it did sort of start to affect various systems pretty early. It started to affect pagers. It started to affect ATMs. They were worried it was going to affect stoplights, I believe. But yeah, you hope there are backup systems, but how long will they last and how robust are they? Because they've never been tested before. They are testing these things in real time for sure in Eastern Europe. They'll be testing in Ukraine. This stuff will be happening in real time. You know, nobody will talk about that kind of thing in Ukraine right now for obvious reasons, but you'll be finding out in Ukraine what it looks like when you can't rely on GPS for civil infrastructure, because in parts of Ukraine, it just isn't there anymore. It's not reliable.
This book is fascinating, Catherine. I have to say, it opened my eyes to things I never even thought about. But if you had to bet, where does GPS go from here? Are we headed towards a more resilient system, or are we just sleepwalking towards chaos?
You know, I think from what I've seen in at least a lot of countries in Europe, the message I think is starting to sink in. In the States, I think there's been maybe a sense of a lack of vulnerability, right? Because, I mean, I'm Canadian. It's kind of the same thing. You've got this massive landmass. You don't have active conflict. But when I was in Norway, you know, for sure, and the UK has come out with a new strategy as well. They call it a PNT, position, navigation, timing, where the idea that so much civil infrastructure is based on this and it's so easy to disrupt, they are definitely looking at what are going to be the options. And it probably won't be one thing. It's probably not going to be a one-to-one replacement. And there's all kinds of like sexy, like quantum and da-da-da and all this. But really what seems to be happening at the moment is they're putting wires back in things, you know? They're putting fiber optic cables back into a lot of civil infrastructure to transfer ultra-accurate time. And they're definitely doing that in Scandinavia, and in the Baltics are particularly affected by this right now. So they can't wait. They're seeing the impact in real time. But yeah, it is one of those risks that it's hard for people in this world because they've been banging the drum about this for a long time. And yet they've faced a lot of indifference, or they faced a lot of, oh, it's somebody else's problem. You know, in the book, I go to Cyprus where they have had issues with aviation for quite a few years now, and they keep on banging the drum and saying, this is going to happen elsewhere, this is going to happen elsewhere. Actually, airline pilots are also people who have really, really sort of been putting the pressure on in recent years and saying, this is a very dangerous situation to be in, and we need sort of redundancies. We need redundancies that people can use. And at the end of the day, it's not foolproof, but you do need those sensory skills. You can't just be kind of neglecting them. You know, if I stop using Google Maps, it's bad. You know, here I'm kind of out with my phone and I'm like this. But worst that happens is I'm late for something by a few minutes, right? It's not a big deal. But for an aviation pilot, if all else fails, they need to be able to land, you know, using those basic skills that they got when they were starting out in their careers. So yeah, it is a bit of a wake-up call. And you could see in U.S. military handbooks, too, they were saying it's not about replacing one system with another. You've got to be able to operate in a system where all of this technology is at risk and you have some basic sensory skills to fall back on.
Well, Catherine Dunn, investigative journalist and author of the new book, Little Blue Dot, How GPS Shaped the Modern World. Thank you so much for being my guest here today on Cool Science Radio. I've learned a lot, and now I know my place in the world.
If you feel, you can feel good about pulling up that map every once in a while and say you're preparing for the day that GPS suddenly conks out.
Thank you for being here today.
Okay, thanks so much.